We don't stick 11 kids on a soccer field when they're 5 years old, right? It's small fields and it's small. So they start playing the snackable sports because it's the easy way to have little bodies running around and playing it. They'll play 3-on-3 basketball and it's a way to get them into the game. And so I think that's a really great entry point. The way that we're creating these sport formats aren't just going to be, oh, because I'm a kid, I can only play this. It's going to be, no, I'm playing 3-on-3 like they do in the Olympics or like they do at the All-Star game or whatever it is. They'll feel like they're a part of that sport. And then
gone are the days of traditional broadcasts and carefully produced content. Sports are moving at the fastest pace we've ever seen, both on and off the field. As we jump back in with Dr. Ann Peguero, we explore something she has been calling the snackable sport, as well as the athlete influencer, and we link it all back to private investment in sport. Together, in this third episode of Sport Intelligence, the State of Sport in Canada, we look at how sport organizations, athletes, and Canadian youth are being impacted by the shifts in media consumption, partnerships, and the rise of athletes as brands. We'll also hear from both an athlete and an NSO along the way. We'll leave off with a look ahead to a future in sport where we've gotten it right and what is most exciting on the horizon. Thanks for joining us as we wrap up this limited series collaboration brought to you by CERC and the Gordon S. Lang School of Business and Economics at the University of Guelph. So last time you talked about how money is reshaping sport and new investment. The other piece I know you want to get to is, in essence, people's attention span. So from your perspective, what's changing in how people actually engage with sport now?
I think you'd have to be living under a rock to not understand how everybody has a phone in their pocket and is constantly on it. I'm just as guilty as everyone else. But that growth of that use has created in our population this attention span that they used to say is less than a goldfish, so 6 seconds or nanoseconds or something. But we all are looking for entertainment, short bursts of it. And sport has the ability to provide that, right? I mean, the first thing you start seeing and you digest on your social media feeds are like sport highlights. So putting this in context, the men's NCAA, there was a last second shot to win a game where UConn beat Duke. And I'm thinking people have been watching that millions of times. It's 10 seconds or less of entertainment, and they'll watch that over and over again. But that's what we're sort of primed to look for now, not sit down and commit hours to watching something. So I think that the rise of social media and our phone use has brought this sort of perfect storm to less attention. And sport has a way to fill that need because we can start with highlights, but we're also always live and have a lot of action to share.
It's interesting because as soon as you started to describe it, I immediately thought of so many examples where sports have already tried to make the game faster or the game has naturally become faster paced over time. Major League Baseball is the first example that comes to mind, and the introduction of the pitch clock, which I think was 2023.
Right.
I've heard you describe something called the snackable sports. So tell me, what does that really mean?
I think it takes traditional sports, so like some of the things we're seeing changing in soccer, and it shortens it. And it creates it in a time frame that people will watch. So I think about the Rio Olympic Games and the advent of rugby sevens. And we watched 30-minute rugby games, fast, furious, high-scoring, nonstop action, 30 minutes and it's over. We now have the same for 3v3 basketball, both in para sport and Olympic sport. And those are played with music, live action. It never stops, right? And I think that's what we're seeing now, this rise of snackable sports. So it's traditional sports finding a way to create smaller versions, shorter versions, less players, 7v7, soccer, football, same thing. And they're put on in a way that is sort of made for short attention spans and quick broadcast, really.
Why is that working right now?
I think we have a really different type of fan. We have these young people that are like, I'm not going to sit down and watch 3 hours or 4 hours of an NFL football game. I think if we look at the demographics for American football, it's probably a much older crowd that have built an entire socializing Sunday around it, right? Where I think we look at the kids that sit in my classroom and they're like, they can't sit for the class. They're not going to sit for that long to watch a sport event. They want something to happen fast. They want to be able to consume it and talk about it really quickly. So I think that's who they're aimed at.
You mentioned football, and even with the recent MLB rule changes, baseball is still also a very traditional format. Do you feel like those are at risk? Do you see a world where these competitions are all 30 minutes instead of 2, 3, or 4 hours?
I think they'll coexist. So for football, we're going to see flag football at LA 28, right? That's a faster game. It's played on smaller fields. It's a different version of it. Things we grew up as girls playing, because that's what they let us play for football. So I do think they coexist. Rugby still has 15s and 7s. We still see traditional full football soccer matches while we see this 7v7. So they're coexisting, but they're getting into different audiences and different broadcast models.
I think it's been mentioned previously, but Schemo, it's like insane.
Yeah.
And also, from my understanding, built completely for TV. I can't imagine trying to follow that the way someone follows a professional golf round in person.
Yeah, there's different versions of it. There's like ones that aren't specific, and I think they're more grueling and longer and involve a lot more technical skill. But that sprint thing was just made for TV. If you look how the course is set up, it's set up such that everything can be filmed in a very small area. And I think if we try to track some of the back to this before we get to the attention span stuff, we saw this with things like X Games and, you know, where they started building purpose-built facilities to put a sport on that was built basically for a young, engaged audience and a broadcast platform. And that sort of just keeps on rolling as we see it now.
When the X Games first came around, from what I remember, they weren't really considered traditional or mainstream sports. Mm. Only now we're starting to see that shift where the definition of sport is getting wider. You mentioned how these different versions could coexist, possibly for different audiences. But I think the reality is that everyone's attention span is changing, right?
Correct.
How can sports survive that without becoming highlight reel only situations?
I think the onus is on the traditional side of these sports to start figuring out how do they transition the quick version of their sport, the viewership of that. And they're not going to get all of them, but how are they going to transition some of them into fans of the, and maybe as they become more avid fans or deeper into the game and the culture around it, they want more of it. And the way you get more of it is watching the full game that's put on in a traditional format. So they've got to start thinking about those transition points. How do they take a viewer of the Snacks Eye sports and move them over? I mean, I think about speed climbing. If you've ever seen that, people in the Olympics, it's like nanoseconds to the top of something. So then how do they get me to sit down and watch a traditional climbing or bouldering competition? How do they get me involved enough that I care about that? And some of it's crossover. Some of the athletes compete in both sides of it. So we see that in rugby. Certainly some play on the 15s, some play on the 7s, and they play both. So I think they've got to start thinking of gateways to moving those fans over to the traditional side.
I'm so curious, as someone in marketing, how do you envision that happening? Do you have that answer?
I do think we need to understand these fans and thinking about, okay, when they become highly identified or more deeply rooted into these sports, they're going to crave more. And at some point, it's like there's not more of the snackable size. So we have to figure out, by asking them, I think, a lot of questions and figuring out what behavior gets them moved. Is it they're going to follow an athlete over to the goes to the traditional sport? Are they more likely to want to consume more? And if the short size of sports is only offered at certain times of the year, then they have no choice but to go to the traditional model of it. I think we need to figure out where those points are. But I would go back to, we need to do some research.
So you mentioned the magic word, research. Tell us, what are we learning about what fans actually want from sports? Yes, we know attention spans are short, but what's enjoyable about the snackable sport in particular?
I think they like to be in the moment. I think that nowadays it's not only about being in the moment and experiencing it, then they all share it, right? Everybody's got to share that their connection to it in some way. Like, I just watched that. Here's the video of my friends reacting to it here. So all of those they compartmentalize and share. So I think it's about, I want to be a part of the moment that happens. And that's the cool thing about sports, why it's always got a live moment and a live component that you sort of need to be present for. And then we watch this sort of spillover and amplification that happens of that content as everybody positions themselves as part of that moment, and it'll keep going on for a couple of weeks. So I think that's what they want. They want to be a part of it. They want to watch it, but then they want to situate it as part of who they are and what they're doing at that time. And I think that there's moments in traditional longer-term sport we can offer them to do that as well.
I want to pause here and bring in a conversation we had with Liam Hickey, a 3-time Paralympian, who spoke with us for a CIRC article on athlete use of social media. On top of the value of fans connecting themselves to a moment in sport, there's also value in fans seeing themselves in sport. The full article can be found on CIRC.ca, but when asked about the value of social media, here's what Liam had to share with us.
I think that is one of the great things about social media is you tend to reach people that didn't even know you existed or didn't know your sport existed or parasport existed. So for me, I think when I'm creating posts specifically around the athletic side of my life and the athlete journey itself, it's just to try and find a way to connect with as many people as possible. I think that's in the last 5 years, 5 to 7 years, that social media has probably been the biggest advantage for us as parasport athletes. The Paralympic movement has been widely supported by social media and how people view it and access it, whether it's TikTok or X, Instagram, etc. I think social media provides that opportunity to reach people of all different ages and cultures, which is massive for something like parasport. When I was growing up, I didn't see much of parasport on social media. But I think when you have maybe a 14, 15 year old kid on Instagram who recently acquired a disability but sees para hockey on Hockey Canada's main feed or Paralympics main feed, then, you know, that does a lot for not only the promotion of the sport, but the inclusion part of it and being able to see yourself in somebody else's shoes.
So I think that's a natural crossover to something else I know we want to get to, which is the athlete influencer. You've highlighted that now we're seeing fans follow athletes above all else, where we used to live in a world of team loyalty and adoration for the sport itself, not necessarily the athletes as individuals. How massive is that shift?
I think we've seen it shift again dramatically with phones and social media, right? And so athletes, and in particular, I'd say women athletes, I will preface it by saying I used to be such a fan of social media. Now I'm not so much a fan, but I studied it for, you know, 15 plus years. And early on, I thought this is going to be the way that women athletes can create fan communities and brands and stuff because they don't get covered by traditional media at that time. And it did work that way. And so a lot of fans started following women athletes, following men athletes, and then they started what we would call parasocial relationships. So you're a famous athlete and I follow you and you show me what you do every day. I feel like we're friends. You have no idea who I am, right? So I feel like we have a relationship and you don't know who the 5 million people are that follows you. And so it creates this closeness where then people want to, you know, fans will buy the clothing that the athlete's wearing, will do the workout the athlete's doing, will buy the food they're buying, and showing in their behind the scenes content that they do. And so they integrate it into their lives as part of their identity and who they are, but they're highly following individuals versus teams, leagues, or federations in any way.
From the perspective of an NSO or even a professional team, how does that impact the organization? You said it, an athlete can become a brand at that point.
Right. And I think that cat's out of the bag, it's happened. And I think we see some NSOs thinking about that. We saw a real innovative partnership with Swimming Canada and Summer McIntosh and Red Bull. Red Bull doesn't sponsor Swimming Canada, sponsors Summer McIntosh. And they had to come to an organizational understanding that Red Bull wants their product logo on Summer's attire when she's competing for Canada. I think other NSOs are going to have to consider it. I think Gymnastics has put together a pool of 5 of their top athletes that brands could associate with. So they're starting to see that. There are many sports that haven't considered this yet. And I've certainly in all of my talks said, this is where the power is. Your athletes now have more agency than they ever had before. And you need to think about how you work in partnership with them to raise the funds and revenue and partnerships for your sport and for the athlete together. If not, the athlete is going to far out earn anything that an NSO can from a partner.
So before Anne gets too far, I want to pause our conversation and share a little bit of Swimming Canada's experience. We spoke with Suzanne Pollins, current CEO of Swimming Canada, and someone who has made a career of it, working at all levels of swimming across the country. When we asked about the changing relationships between athletes, NSOs, potential sponsors, here's what she shared with us in the context of Summer McIntosh and Red Bull.
So I think we've seen this grown over the last number of years as athletes establish their own brands. And as the National Sport Organization, I think what has changed is we find ourselves now working with athletes and their agents, sometimes with athletes and their agents and their parents, and then also the sponsors and partners of both the NSO. Some may exist within the NSO and the athlete, and some may be athlete only. I think there is a recognition and understanding that there's a need to allow the athlete to build their platform and their partnerships, but also a balance and a need to ensure that there is an understanding and education for the athlete around the Swimming Canada partner that exist, the obligations athletes have through those partnerships that the NSO has. And I think in most cases, the needs and the brands of the athlete and the national office can coexist and benefit both, but there needs to be that open communication to ensure that there is understanding both ways on what the athlete's deal and partnership looks like and what the NSO partnerships look like. And I think they can be mutually beneficial.
And so in saying that, what does that look like for Swimming Canada in the current example that we're talking about?
With that deal, it was Red Bull had the sponsorship agreement with Summer First. So that deal was hers. It was very much cultivated between her and her circle of people. But I think what Red Bull identified is that there were Swimming Canada, so national office, assets that would be beneficial to what they were trying to do within the sport. And so when you think about specifically the competition suit, that is a Swimming Canada asset that we could sell. But what we did, we unlocked the suit for the sponsor and for the athlete to come in and go, we want that brand on her competition suits, not only domestically, but internationally as well. Which then you factor in that you've got an international federation that you're also working with the rules and sponsorship and partners of an international federation, which may not always align as well. And so Red Bull, one of the things is they really wanted that logo on the suit. And so we created a partnership where that was unlocked. And so then Summer could work with Red Bull on what that meant for her. So from the NSO perspective, there were other pieces of that sponsorship arrangement partnership that were unique to Swimming Canada and Red Bull. And Summer did very effectively work with Red Bull on the partnership agreement that existed between her and them.
So now that we've heard a little bit more about what that experience is like for an NSO and how they're looking at it, how does that translate to the larger landscape?
That's what I think we have to realize is the athletes that are in our training pathways are now in the NCAA in the States, a large proportion of them, and they're either getting paid a salary or they're part of name, image, and likeness deals, and they're making money. And so if they're doing that, they have expectations of how their relationship works with their sport. They're at a university and they have a head coach and they have a whole training environment, but they're getting paid and they're making money. And so when they come back to their NSO environment, they're going to have some expectations of how that NSO is dealing with them in terms of any partnerships or opportunities to make money.
So I think that's a shift in dynamics amongst athletes even.
Yeah. And I think it's going to create certainly a have and have not. It's not like there are bobsled NCAA scholarships, right? When you think about bobsledders, luge, skeleton, they're a different kind of group as an example that toils in pretty much anonymity for 3 years of every four. And then when it's an Olympic year, they get a lot. But it's one of the reasons of the struggle because they are holding down jobs and still trying to compete in their sport. And I think with both the rise of athlete agency and social media, that gap is going to start to widen for athletes who can't figure out a pathway for themselves. It's a lot of work. You know, we see it with para athletes. It's the same. Running your own media platform is a full-time job if you're also trying to train for your sport and probably earn some other money to be able to live. So it's a real balance that we're putting them into.
Is our sports system ready to really support athletes in this way?
I'm not sure all of them are. It's certainly a conversation that I've put on the table in the last year with any NSO I've talked to and said, your athletes are out there getting agents and they are signing deals. And these are things that you can build in-house to support them. As they come through your pathways, you should be offering them the support of either finding an agent or running an athlete agency across a bunch of NSOs so that there's support in the system for them and they're not constantly operating outside the system and then trying to bring their packages back in. As much as I think NSOs and have professionalized, there's a whole sort of side, I think, that they can look at in terms of a win-win for revenue for them and the athletes together.
Okay, so if the system becomes open to that new normal, how do NSOs or other organizations rethink their partnerships, their marketing strategies?
Yeah, I think if you're thinking ahead as an NSO, and I know it's hard when you're also dealing with resource issues, but we have to start thinking about how do you look at your athletes and profile them and put together a package when you're talking to a partner, right? And there are some sports where athletes sign over their name, image, and likeness to the NSOs when they become part of them. There's some where they retain some of those, but how do you work together, right? And so I think if you start to think about inside your organization, what I would call an athlete dashboard, can you create a dashboard that talks about everything that athlete's done on the field, on the pitch, running, whatever it is, and their medals and the events they've done it, but also, you know, everything about their social media followers, how many do they have? What do they talk about in their social media? And then you work that together with a brand and say, look, we've got John or we got Mary over here and they're our top athletes. Here's what they do that's going to attract people in terms of their performance, but here's what they bring in terms of an audience to your brand if you partner with us. And that it might be like, how come I can't just partner with the athlete? And I think that some will just do that. Others will want to embed themselves in the sport, right? So you get Mary, plus you get everyone who's coming up behind her. That's just as good. And we're seeing a few of these deals happen in the NCAA, like with UConn women's basketball right now. So they have AZ Fudd, who's amazing, and she's got all these deals like Geico and whatever thing, but they've now created one with the team and some of the top athletes, and they're doing some behind the scenes content. And so a brand has said, like, I want UConn basketball. I want the top three players to appear in my ad campaign during March Madness, and they're putting it together as a package. We see some athletes who are like that for their teammates, who say, if you want me, my three teammates are coming and we're a package to do this. So I've seen some of that in the NCAA, and I think we could see some of that if we think about beach volleyball. It's duo sport, should be a pair together, right? Should be marketing them as a pair together. I think on 3v3 basketball, that's a four-person team. That's a great package too for an organization to put together. So I think there just needs to be a little innovative thinking and working with athletes as opposed to against them, I think.
You're listening to Sport Intelligence, the State of Sport in Canada, hosted by CERC and Dr. Anne Peguerrero with the Gordon S. Lang School of Business and Economics at the University of Guelph. I mean, in all of this, we're still talking about money, right? But now looking at private equity, why could sports suddenly be attractive to investors?
So private equity is money that sits outside the stock market and public companies, right? So this is large investment funds, and they're always looking for a return that's higher than the market will give them. And if you look at sport over time, particularly professional men's sport, the return on the growth of the value of franchises has outperformed stock market growth year over year. And so it is really ripe for an investment. And so private equity comes in and it wants to put money in for a short period of time, have a high growth, and then exit and take their winnings in a sense and move on to the next thing they'll invest in. So what we're seeing in terms of sports started in professional sport for sure, right? But I think what they quickly started to see is there's a massive opportunity at the youth sport level, particularly in the United States. It's a $40, $50 billion industry where people spend minimally $1,000 a year just for fees for a kid to play, but upwards of $20,000 to $50,000 depending on the travel sport they play. And so we saw some really big companies come in, two in particular, Three Step Sport and Unrivaled, and they have purchased a big part of the youth sport ecosystem. They own baseball academies. They own IMG Academy, which was a place where people trained for years. They own volleyball leagues. And so they've built an entire youth sport ecosystem that really makes them a lot of money. And so that's where I think there's opportunity and there's scare, a little bit nervous about that.
Well, I was just going to say, my first reaction was a nervous one, I'll be honest. This could be a really volatile system where money is made or lost, put in, taken out at will. So what are the risks of increased private investment in sport?
I think it makes our accessibility potentially worse. And so there's some good examples that came out in the United States where they looked at, I think it's Michigan and or Massachusetts, and they had privatized most of their ice hockey rinks. And so ice hockey costs just keep going up. And then they look at Minnesota, where they didn't do that. And in Minnesota, they still have great access. They have amazing hockey players coming out of Minnesota. And they've created a way that they still have really good school sport and really good access to rinks because private equity doesn't own it. So my concern about it is our system in Canada is so reasonable resource starved, that private equity, it's a right place for private equity to put money in because we haven't been able to achieve growth because we haven't had money to fuel it, right? And so if we see private equity coming in and look, I could start building some soccer academies or some basketball academies in Canada and start to make a lot of money, what we're going to start to see is that access issue become bigger, right? Because every parent that we know, or the majority of them, thinks their child is the next superstar and is willing to pay money. And in Canada, minimally, they're paying $1,000 to $1,500. But we know, and I hear people talk about travel hockey being $30,000 or basketball costing that kind of money. And so I see that there's a real right place for private equity to come into, but that's such a double-edged sword for us right now.
Could that shift who controls sport in Canada, though?
Quite potentially, yes. I think at the youth level, for sure. I think at the national level, we have an opportunity. Look, we have this government right now that's focused on Build Canada. So I think we're looking at infrastructure projects. And I think I've said this several times, but I mean, every town has a Centennial Arena. That's the last time, 1967. And to be clear, before I was born, they put big money into infrastructure for sport. And so I think that's where we could start to think about private equity playing a different role, as opposed to owning our leagues and our accessibility. Could we form more structured partnerships with private equity around public-private partnerships? So in instance, if we need facilities, we work with a municipality and the municipality provides the land. We build with a private-public partnership the facility that we need, and the city can still monetize the parking lot to get back some money. And we can keep it accessible because we're using that. We don't have to buy the land. So the cost, the initial investment cost for the public-private partnership is not that big, right? As if trying to build the entire thing. So that way we can keep the need for the return on investment lower because the initial investment is lower. And so any growth is going to provide that. But we still have other revenue streams that can keep that accessible for people. So we need to think strategically about how do we use private equity money to build some infrastructure we need, but to keep it accessible at the same time.
Now that you've mentioned accessibility, particularly around youth sport, I'm curious. Youth sport is both a massive industry and becoming increasingly inaccessible from a financial perspective. So how does that tension play out in your mind?
Yeah, it's a tough one because I think, again, we're talking about a national sports system that needs money. We know that pretty much everything that's happening at our youth sport level or grassroots is a pay-to-play kind of model, right? Some of it's accessible and not that expensive. Where the gap seems to have happened, and I don't know when this exactly happened, I'd have to go back and look, because I grew up playing my sports in school. And school was the accessible place, right? And right now we're sort of like, when we're having these conversations, I don't hear people talking about school sports. I don't hear them saying that this is a set of infrastructure and a place that kids spend a big part of their time every day where we could reinvigorate accessible sport. And then if we do have these superstar kids or really want to passionate, there's ways that we can help fund them to get accessible to club sport and youth sport outside of school. But we've sort of abandoned the school sport avenue in Canada for some reason.
So I want to come back around to where this conversation started, because I think we know it's all connected.
Yeah.
Do the idea of snackable sports and athlete influencers change how kids are exposed to sport and where their entry point is now?
I think it does. We see the way that some sports are played, and a snackable sport's an easy way in. And we do this already in our performance pathways. We don't stick 11 kids on a soccer field when they're 5 years old, right? It's small fields and it's small. So they start playing the snackable sports because it's the easy way to have little bodies running around and playing it. They'll play 3-on-3 basketball, and it's a way to get them into the game. And so I think that's a really great entry point. The way that we're creating these sport formats aren't just going to be, oh, because I'm a kid, I can only play this. It's going to be, no, I'm playing 3-on-3 like they do in the Olympics or like they do at the All-Star game or whatever it is. They'll feel like they're a part of that sport, and then they can move themselves up to the full field or the full court size. So I think that it does provide a real interesting gateway to get kids into sport, because now they feel like, oh, it's not just a sport made for little kids. It's a sport everybody plays. So again, it's like isolating parts of the game that are shorter. It's how we grew up. We played in the playground. And so they're bringing that back as parts of the game. And I think those are ways to, they're also going to be avenues to get kids in. They're going to want to replicate that. They're going to go out and try to play it at the gym or the playground, and they'll take it with them. And it's another way to get them into participating.
How revolutionary is this for our sports system in Canada? Is this a complete reset moment that we're seeing?
I think evolution. I would like to think that it's hard to reset the entire sports system, but I think we're looking at an evolution. We're looking at so many factors in the sports system are changing. We can talk a lot, and we have over time, about the lack of funding for it. But we've also talked about the influence of immigration. And now we're talking about snackable sports and private equity. There's so many moving parts in the external environment that's going to impact the sports system in Canada, from the youth to the high performance level, that I think we're going to see quite an evolution. Because with this much going on, you can't stay status quo. It's just not going to work.
Okay. So then tell us, what does success look like in Canada for that evolution in sport?
Ooh, that's a great question. What does success look like? I think that we have to have NSOs and athletes working in partnership. I think we're going to see that as a success model. I think we're going to look at public-private partnerships to build the infrastructure. That's going to be a success for us as Canadians. And I think that we're going to have to look at sport leaders coming together to start to figure out how the sports system works together in the environment that they're not competing with each other. They actually need to be a more coherent. So for me, success down the road in 5 years from now would be, we've been able to, through the way we've thought about this, to keep sport accessible financially for everyone to play. We've maybe reinvigorated school sports as an avenue in Canada. And we're seeing our NSOs leading at the top, figuring out how they work together. And to me, that probably means there's less NSOs than we have now. There's a consolidation in the system where they figure out how to work together, and or they're building sort of strategic alliances or organizations that are going to work across sports for all, whether it's going to be working with a way to harness AI for all sports or build a marketing agency for our athletes. There's things that they're going to do to reset what our system looks like. And to me, that'll help right from the top all the way down.
When we looked at everything you've talked about, from the macro trends, the new money, the snackable sport, the athlete influencers, there's a lot there. And what would be the one idea that you would want sport leaders to walk away from this series remembering?
I think the one idea is that I think it's time that Canadian sport organizations were the agent of change and not the object of it. I think there's a prime opportunity. I know it's hard when you've been struggling with no increased resources, but it really, I don't know there'd be a better moment to take advantage of everything that's shifting your environment to really reorient your organization and how it could partner with others and start to be that agent of change. I think any organization that's able to do that now is going to come out of this in a pretty winning situation.
Before we wrap up the conversation with Anne and get some final thoughts, I want to bring back Suzanne from Swimming Canada to share what it sounds like when an NSO starts to lean in as a potential agent of change and moves beyond the reactionary approach.
To make things interesting, different swim meets have looked at, you start with so many swimmers, they race, then you go down to four, then you go down to two, as just another unique way to engage. So I think in swimming, even though it's a very traditional sport, I think there's constantly thought around how do you modernize it within the realms of the sport is the sport, you know, take your marks, go, and they race. But what can you do to try and engage more? And so you'll never make everyone happy, but trying out different things as we go along.
Okay, so final question, or questions, I guess. Where do you see sport in Canada in 5 years? What does it look like if we get it right? Or what excites you the most, I guess?
If we get this right, I think we see ourselves with a system that is evolving into better resourced, more athlete focused, and one that is following some of the best pathways to building sustainability. I think it's a sustainable sports system to me would come out in the 5 years, so that we're not constantly having the talk about how much more money needs to go into it, right? And we can move on from that and making sure that we're building the best sort of safe, inclusive, and welcoming sport environment for everybody. And we get steady, right? We're the country now people are going to turn to and say, hey, listen, this is how you build a sports system that's sustainable, that works with its athletes, that takes into account the environment it works in and takes advantage of trends that are coming its way, that is built for immigrants and Canadians across across the board. I'm hoping that we're still going to see the continued rise of women's sport and its excitement that it brings to Canadians. We have such phenomenal women athletes in this country. I'm excited about the WNBA franchise. All those things that it's going to put into the sports system that makes young girls and boys excited to join sports. I'm excited about seeing and talking to the NSO leaders because they are a great group. And it's awesome to be in a room with them and let them share their experiences. There are some big brains in there. But I think the one thing I'm most excited for is for the things that happen in those rooms to spill out and start to actually get implemented. And I feel like we're at that place now. We can't talk anymore. We actually have to start doing this change and working together. We've got some pretty amazing things happening in Canada. All these things bring a lot of hope and excitement into sports. And every time I think about that, I think about there's a young kid somewhere that's getting inspired to walk out the door and play or join a league. And I think that's what we're all in it for.
Wow, three episodes that could have easily been 30. First and foremost, hats off to Dr. Anne Peguerrero for coming to the table with so many ideas and so much for us all to consider. We'd also like to thank all of the guests we heard from, including Suzanne Pollins, in today's conversation. The firsthand experiences everyone brought to the table really gave life to some of the things that we've talked about with Anne. I'm Taylor Matthews, and this has been the Sport Intelligence Podcast, brought to you by CERC. In this limited series, The State of Sport in Canada, with Dr. Anne Peguerrero and the Gordon S. Lang School of Business and Economics at the University of Guelph. Until next time.